The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. This is News Talk, and I'm Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, Ireland has lost about two pubs a week since 2006. We'll be looking at the once great pubs of yesteryear, the famous places for a tipple or a pint of plain. We'll take a swing at Sinn Féin's housing plan and see does it stack up with a top architect. We look at the government's spend of $336,000 for a bike shed and wonder if you can get one for less. And we'll be looking at autumn styling with our new interiors expert, Paul Kinsella. That is coming up on today's show. We are delighted to have you with us. And if you would like to get in contact with us, you can email us today or during the week at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over on all the socials, on X and on Instagram as SineadRyan100. Now, there was lots of money being chucked about Leinster House this week, and it's still a month before the budget. First, we heard about the third of €1 million of our money being spent on a bike stand, which holds about 18 bikes and doesn't seem to be weatherproofed. That's a spend of €18,000 per bike. I wonder if any of the bikes in it are worth €18,000. I very much doubt it. Then Sinn Féin announced €39 billion spend on its ambitious housing plan. Well, we'll be taking an expert, non-political eye to both and see if the Home Show can do it all for a little bit cheaper. So do stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you might need a strong drink for our first item, even if it is a bit early. But if not, well, listen, have a nice cup of coffee, whether you're stuck in bed and you're listening to me or you're out walking the dog, you're very welcome along to the Home Show. Pubs come and pubs go, and we've been finding out in recent weeks that they seem to be going more often than they used to and than we would like. Well, author and founder of the Three Castles Burning podcast, Donal Fallon, is currently writing a history of Dublin's public houses. And today we're going to look at some of the lost pubs of the capital as Donal joins me in studio now. You're very welcome.
Good to be here.
You're on
good
a cup here. Of tea there.
Yeah,
not a pint.
To be drinking not a pint. On the radio. It's a cup of tea.
All right. Well, that's probably a good start for the time of day it is. So talk to me a little bit about, I know you're kicking off the books and you're probably in the research stage now and you're looking at that. That sounds like tough research now, Donal.
Very tough research.
The pubs of Dublin.
And I suppose the big question that's at the beginning of that is, what do you define a pub as? Mm. And if you were to open the dictionary, they'd tell you a pub is a drinking establishment licensed to serve alcoholic drinks for consumption on the premises. But I've kind of had to come to terms with that. Even that's changing. You know, and people might remember the Virgin Mary on Capel Street that didn't last too long, that non-alcoholic pub. But Board on Clonbrassil Street in Dublin is doing really well. They don't serve alcohol. They have board games. People go there, play board games, drink non-alcoholic drinks. That is still, by every other standard of definition, a public house. You know, in terms of what it is. So there's a broader question, what makes a pub? And I think really pubs are defined by, for me, it's the physicality of them. You know, you walk into it, there's the bar, there's the snug, the lounge, whatever else it might be. And there's people. And it's really remarkable in this country. We've got this beautiful thing called the Dictionary of Irish Biography, a who's who of Irish history. When you go through that, not only are there publicans in it, there's actually barmen in it. Paddy O'Brien, a very legendary barman who moved from MacDade's to Grogan's and kind of created the literary pub that Grogan's is today. So I don't think there's any other country in the world where barmen reach that status that they become, you know, part of the collective history, if you will, of a city and an industry.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, I was writing about it actually during the week in my column in the Irish Independent, and I was talking about, because I was on the back of the vintners looking for excise reductions in the budget and all that kind of thing. But actually, I did a little bit of work on it, and it turned out that there's one pub for every 528 people, adults, in Ireland. And when you take into account the 1 million or so non-drinkers, like that to me smacked of enough. Yeah. But there was this big disparity between rural Ireland, where maybe you have to travel to get to a pub that's now still open, and Dublin, where you go three steps down the road and you're going to fall into one, you know. Yeah. And there is that sense of pubs maybe having to offer more and more and more things to entice people in. You were talking about the board games, you know, in the non-alcoholic pub. But then you have the gastro pubs. Most of them now seem to offer at least a sandwich or something like that.
Yeah,
music, televisions, all that stuff.
I've read a lot of stuff from the 50s and the 60s in the newspapers about pubs and, you know, what should a pub be and what shouldn't a pub be. I mean, in the 60s, there were still pubs advertising in newspapers, no ladies on the premises. It's extraordinary. But people were complaining and moaning about the arrival of cocktails, and they were complaining and moaning amongst other things about you know, women being served pints. So there's always been these questions around just what a pub should be offering or shouldn't be offering.
Yeah, and now you can walk in and you can ask for any one of 10 gins because they're definitely going to have, with all the fruit and veg that goes into it, you know. So the proposition has changed over the years for sure. But people always have their favourite pubs, don't, and the ones that really have gone down in folklore nearly. So talk to me about some of those. I mean, we know the Stag's Head is probably one of the most famous, only because it claims to be the oldest, or Johnny Fox's up the mountains. But there are loads of them.
There's loads of pubs that have disappeared. And you know, that's the great question in Ulysses. They're asked, how do you go across Dublin without passing a pub? And the answer was, you go into every one of them. But if you were to try and map the city of Dublin and look at where pubs have disappeared, there's actually an entire type of pub that is more or less almost gone, which was the early house pub. And there was once more than 40 of them across the city.
Beloved of the press industry of old.
Yeah. You could walk into any one of them and see Conhoolan, you know. There's only a handful of them remaining. And even of the ones that remain, only three are, I would say, proper early houses. There are three pubs in the city that open at 7 a.m.
Yeah, now remind listeners who may not remember or have been in an early pub, why they are there and what their rules are.
So where are they? First, that gives you a sense why they exist. So they're clustered around the markets area and around the Docklands area. So these were pubs that kind of catered to people who their working day was ending, you know, when the rest of us were getting out of bed. The fruit and veg market by Smithfield, between Smithfield and Capel Street, for example, and then the area around the docks. So containerisation destroyed the Docklands. The workforce just disappeared overnight. The fruit and veg market has been closed for a long, long time. And what you see is that the cluster of early houses around it especially are disappearing. So the Chancery was a particularly famous example there on the quays. And the sign is still hanging, the early morning bird with the city behind it. The White Horse was another early house, a very famous one actually because of its popularity with journalists. It was right beside the Irish Press newspaper. And the White Horse is now a Starbucks. In a former life, actually, it was also a great gig venue, Green Day. Perform their first Dublin
gig. Now, mind
there.
You, I mean, I suppose you could argue that what you need now early in the morning is a cup of coffee rather than a pint, but it's a stretch for sure.
The White Horse at the end of its life rebranded itself the Dark Horse. And I remember they were hosting kind of early morning raves, kind of like 7 a.m. to midday raves. So they had that early house license, but yet more and more pubs that have early house licenses don't use them. The Hacienda, very famous pub now in Dublin where Taylor Swift goes for a pint. It has an early house licence, but it doesn't use it. So they still exist,
right. And of course, we have some of the ones that would have been very famous that kind of sometimes can kind of lend their demise. I mean, one of them I know, the Scruffy Murphys, notorious for two things. One was that the consortium that got together and won the lotto by buying up all the tickets in Dublin. And it worked.
Yeah.
And that was what made the lottery people change the number of combinations so that you couldn't mathematically, financially win the lotto by guarantee. And the other notorious thing was that it was where I had my first alcoholic drink. And I don't know what age I was, very, very young. And I had no idea what to order. So I went with a whiskey and red lemonade, which neither of which I've drunk to this day. So it clearly wasn't an excellent combination. I'd say the poor old barman was shrinking. And then you have the other one, like
I walked by one on the way.
Yeah,
kind of, just around the corner from News Talk. There's the Grafton Hotel. And the bar of the Grafton Hotel is called Bartley's, which is a little nod to
Bartley Dunn's.
And in New York, it's a wonderful new Irish bar. I like these new Irish bars that are emerging in the US. You know, it's very different from McSorley's in the old days of you can have the pint in any colour you want as long as it's black.
Yeah.
But Bartley Dunn's and Rice's, both in this area, kind of popular pubs. Newspaper said that they had a bohemian and avant-garde crowd, which in mid-20th century Ireland, of course, meant they were gay-friendly.
Yeah.
Norris, David Norris remembers going into Bartley's in his memoir, the place was full of theatrical old queens. But these were gay-friendly bars. So that's another
at a time when you couldn't be.
Yeah, but they're not gay bars.
Gay-friendly
bars.
Yeah.
And it's only when the Viking comes along, which is now Brogan's on Dame Street, that you had an explicitly, you know, loud and proud gay bar.
Gosh, okay.
So yeah. Bartley Dunn's might be gone, but it remains the fact that there's a pub named in its honour in Dublin and New York. It's still part of the
fondness that people have. And of course, the other one that closed and there was a great deal of controversy over it was the Bernard Shaw in Portobello.
Yeah.
Because there was a whole thing about why was it closing? It had been derelict for a while and it was supposed to be some, they were calls to rescue it. It didn't get rescued.
No, and I was in Berlin not too long ago and I tried to visit my favourite pub in Berlin and someone said the pub has moved. And I said, that's very strange. How can a pub move? In other cities, they think this is quite normal. That, you know, a pub is the owners and the staff and the people who drink there, not the physical premises. I don't think that applies here. I think it's unique in Dublin.
Mm.
And the Bernard Shaw Portobello pub closed its doors in 2019. The owners reopen it across the river at Phibsborough. They have the old sign from Portobello on the front of the building. It's a bigger space. In some ways, it's a better space. It's got a better dedicated club space. But to me, it's not the Bernard Shaw. You know, I don't think it's possible to take a pub from one part of the city to move it from one canal to another and to keep the spirit of it.
And you're quite right, because you're moving all the important things that people like, but actually it is the physical location that people went for. Because when you said, I'll meet you at Scruff's or I'll meet you at the, you know, the Bernard Shaw, everybody knew, you could visualise that part of town, the street, what you were going to be around it, where, what bus you'd get in, all that stuff. And moving it across the river isn't the same.
Yeah, it isn't. It isn't. And pubs are still moving. I mean, the strange thing about writing this book is there are pubs that are going to move in the near future. So you're writing about pubs that still exist, but won't for much longer. The Brian Boru, great pub.
Yeah.
200 years of history in the Brian Boru, right beside Glasnevin Cemetery. Quite an emotional pub for a lot of people because it's where afters tend to happen, you know, after a funeral in the cemetery next door. But the Metrolink is going to remove the Brian Boru. And the question is, should they name the station there the Brian Boru? Should they keep the
interesting
beautiful mural? There's a great mural of the High King of Ireland on the side of the pub. Should they keep it and incorporate it into the metro station?
Yeah.
Who knows? So, yeah, pubs
no
are
drinking
still,
on the Lewis, folks. No.
Still disappearing, yeah.
I'm speaking with Donal Fallon, a social historian, about favourite pubs. And folks, if you have a favourite pub and one you'd hate to see closed, do let us know about it at thehomeshow@newstalk.com, because we'd love to hear what your favourite pub is. What's your own favourite, Donal, by the way?
There's a couple of pubs I like for different reasons. I mean, I'm very close to Grogan's, Castle Lounge, just around the corner from here. I got to know Tommy Smith, one of the co-owners of that, very well. And I just love the fact that there's no television and no radio. I think that really gives it a kind of unique ambiance, and I hope it stays that way forever.
Rare.
But others that I love, I mean, I love Piper's Corner, just off O'Connell Street there in Marlborough Street. It's a great traditional music pub. And I think that pub is a good example of when we ask the question, what will the pubs look like in future? You know, people are drinking less. There was that very interesting research recently that not only are people drinking less in Ireland, young people especially are drinking less, and they're changing the way that they socialise. So when you walk into a pub like Piper's Corner or Walsh's in Stony Batter, not a great traditional music pub, I mean, there's as many cups of tea as pints at the table.
Yeah.
People are playing music.
Indeed. And I suppose people wouldn't perhaps remember now that at a time when Dublin was much smaller and it was broken up into kind of, I'm not going to say elites, but groups of people, writers, artists, musicians, they each favoured certain pubs because it was the meeting place where you would get, kind of have that meeting with other people and you'd have that inspiration. I'm thinking of MacDade's, you know, very well known.
MacDade's, when Paddy O'Brien, the head barman, is scooped by Tommy and Grogan's, he moves the entire literary set from MacDade's. I think it was Dominic Behan described it as the ship deserting the sinking rats. You know, it's an unusual moment. O'Donoghue's on Merrion Row by accident.
Yeah,
that was a pub you weren't allowed singing. And then when the singing began in the 60s, it just never stopped. You know?
Right. And that now became, they shore up all the politicians and nobody else wants to go.
It's extraordinary that O'Donoghue's can now very, very fairly market itself as the pub where, you know, the Dubliners sang and Joe Heaney sang and everything else. But it was once a pub where music wasn't allowed. So the whole meaning of a pub can shift very, very quickly.
Yeah.
As happened in the case of O'Donoghue's when, you know, a couple of bearded men with banjos began changing its meaning.
And I suppose sometimes then it can be a bit depressing when you see a massive chain like Wetherspoons coming in. But actually, you are more fondly kind of associated with Wetherspoons than I am.
No, I mean, the writing this book has made me think a little bit differently about Wetherspoons. There's a lot to criticise Wetherspoons about. But I think one of the interesting things about their model in the UK is that they often repurpose old sites. So in England, you know, in a city like Birmingham, London, Manchester, Liverpool, it might be an old closed down Art Deco cinema. You know, it might be a theatre, it might be a bank or whatever can be repurposed. And they tend to do that quite sympathetically in a way that nods towards what was there before.
And so they've done that with their new offering, or not new, but their latest offering up on Camden Street there. Beautiful building.
That was a stained glass studio at one point, and they've incorporated that story into the site quite well. So there are many, many problems with the Wetherspoons model, but I think the way they treat architecture is something that's kind of admirable. And then you've got this weird phenomenon. We're talking about pubs that have disappeared. I mean, Irish society is changing. Other things are disappearing too. Churches are disappearing, or at least they don't have congregations anymore. I think about the church, the pub up by Jervis Street. That's where Arthur Guinness was married. Wolfe Tone was baptised there. That's a former, you know, Protestant church that is now a pub and a restaurant and a very, very busy venue. So we're talking about the decline of the pub, and the pubs are disappearing. Yeah. Other things are disappearing too. And that's what's so fascinating about architecture, isn't it? These built structures that can't be knocked down.
Exactly.
And important.
The push to kind of, I suppose it is welcome, the push to repurpose rather than knock down.
Absolutely.
And if pubs are doing that, well, fair play to them, isn't that right? Okay, well, listen, Donald, the book won't be out until next year. Well, if you want to listen to Donal and hear all he has to say, and there's lots and lots of interest, then of course you can listen to the Three Castles Burning Pod, which he hosts. And we will await that book with bated breath, unless you do a little bit too much research, Donal, in which case.
Someone said you should write a book about Irish pubs, you know, from the Hybee down in Cork to the Sunflower in Belfast. And I don't think my relationship would survive that. We'll keep it to Dublin.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for taking out the time to join us on the Home Show today. Now, Sinn Féin launched its €39 billion housing plan called A Home of Your Own in the last week. It includes, among other elements, 300,000 new homes over 5 years and a spend of more than €4 billion additionally per year without, the party claims, increasing any taxes. But is any of it achievable? And more importantly, if it is, why hasn't it been done? Well, here to take the politics out of it and look at what's actually proposed is Assistant Professor in the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy at UCD, Orla Hegarty. Orla, you're very welcome along to the Home Show. Now, you've had a read of these proposals here, which have been 2 years in the making, apparently. What are your initial thoughts?
First thoughts is it's very wide ranging. There's a lot in it. There's a lot of technical detail. It covers a lot of subjects that maybe some of the housing plans don't, in terms of sustainability and quality controls, which I think is quite welcome. And it does mention regeneration and use of existing buildings. So it is a broad plan. It is quite technical. I suppose on the surface, people may not see some of that. But I think it has a lot of potential in some of the nuance in some of the detail.
Okay, so well thought out and plenty in it. Now, I know one of the controversial elements, or at least the newer elements in it, is around the area of who owns the land under which these new houses will be built, or any new houses will be built. And at present, it's the person who owns the house, if it's in a private build. But Sinn Féin are proposing in this that wouldn't be the case.
That's what's proposed. So what's proposed is that you would buy your house in the normal way. You would have a mortgage, you could extend and you could decorate in whatever way you like, and you can keep it and pass it on to your children. But they will detach, if you like, the cost or ownership of the land from the house. And this is a mechanism, I suppose, of bringing affordability into the market without the risk of bringing down prices for other homeowners and the risk of negative equity and the risk to the banks. So it sets almost a market that's in parallel to the existing ownership market, which is set at an affordable level. And therefore, obviously, the price that you could sell at in the future would be capped, because you can't have say people buying a new affordable home at 300,000 and then flipping it a year later at 400,000. So this mechanism is a way of benchmarking that to a lower level price market right into the future.
Now, would that mean then, like from a developer's point of view, would that mean then that they don't have to kind of construct the built element under the house? Is that owned by the government, and is it, would it be kind of brought in terms of would it mean development levies would be gone, for instance? Is that how that cost would be achieved?
The plan is that what the state would be bringing to the table is the land, the infrastructure for that land, so as you say, paid for by development levies, and the things that need to happen to develop that house. But rather than what's happening at the moment, which is that is a subsidy that goes to the developer effectively in the process, the state is going to keep a benefit for their investment in the social and economic benefits of affordable housing will accrue in the long term to the state for that level of investment. So rather than the money being gone in the first transaction, you start to build up a stock of houses, and the state has taken a stake, if you like, in that process that the state sees a benefit for.
Yes, and of course the state, current government has already kind of have a sort of a financial plan around a stake in the market with the first home, the shared equity scheme. So it's not a world away, except that that's a loan and you have to repay it back. Do you see, Orla, any constitutional issues with that? I mean, at the moment we know that compulsory purchase order, for instance, can only be used in very extreme or rare circumstances. But if the state owns the land under your house, what's stopping it running roughshod through it with a road or a bus lane or something?
Well, it's the constitutional law, and that wouldn't be my area, but I haven't heard of anybody in that area who's raised the issue. I suppose to contrast it with the shared equity scheme that you mentioned there, you know, in the longer term, that is not necessarily a good deal for the person buying it, because that debt for the remaining portion is always hanging over you, and there's always the risk of prices will fall. So, you know, I think maybe when banks start to look at this and whether they will allow mortgage lending on it, I think the first indications have probably been good. But you can see from the banking point of view that the less you loan people, the more likely they are to pay it, and they won't have distress over that payment. But also, you know, in comparison with the shared equity scheme, this would seem to me slightly less risky, because the overall mortgage long term for that buyer will be lower, and any risk of negative equity, it's not quite in the same market. So less volatility, I would have thought, in this market than maybe in the broader market.
Indeed. Now, €2 billion for acquisitions, €8 billion for social and affordable homes each year, 300,000 homes before 2030. I mean, that's a big ask. Like, from your perspective, Orla Hegarty, where will the people come to build it? Where will the architects and the developers come?
It's a very big ask, but I think what it does do, you know, we haven't really since the crash had an effort to rebuild the construction industry in housing. What we've had really is incentivizing land developers with the view that they will invigor the construction industry and lead to more employment. But that's a very uncertain thing, and we can see it in housing completions this year, which might surprise people. In the second quarter of this year, housing completions are actually down on last year. So incentivizing developers isn't necessarily a way to build capacity in the construction industry. What you need is a kind of regular, solid pipeline that people can become new developers, become small builders, and have a certainty about there being money there and a continuity. Now, when you're in a volatile land market and a lot of uncertainty around all the international investment, interest rates and those things, you know, there's a lot of things that can influence whether housing is delivered. And we can see that pattern this year. You know, in the Dublin commuter region, completions are down 19% in the second quarter and 10% in Dublin. So, you know, high incentives doesn't necessarily increase output. So I think as a more certainty, you know, if you take the need to bring land and finance to the table out of it for even new small developers or builders who want to get involved, you're taking a lot of the risk out. And I think you'll see more progress on capitalising and building capacity.
Indeed. And I suppose if the government is providing low-cost financing, well, then they can gear upwards with private funding on top of that more easily.
Yeah, you know, and start to build apprenticeships and invest in equipment and all the things that need to happen.
Okay, but it still makes us circle back around to our old friend, the planning system. I mean, do we have the wherewithal? Sinn Féin is proposing a national building company to replace presumably the Land Development Agency. I mean, you know, 300,000 in 5 years sounds aspirational, but it sounds almost impossible when you think it takes 2 years just to get from design to turning a sod at the moment.
Well, it doesn't have to. I mean, there are actually a lot of sites with planning permission out there. You know, planning is often used as the excuse for delay, but there are a lot of sites out there, and a lot of the delay is often when developers go back for a better planning application, or they, you know, push the limits a little bit to get more height or more density. So, you know, the planning delays, yes, in some cases, but there are plenty of planning applications out there. And in fact, if we look at the story this week for the Dundrum Hospital redevelopment site.
Yes, 900, nearly 1,000 apartments, yeah.
Yeah, but the local authority are going to apply for planning now through their own mechanism, which has always been there. And you know, you would just question, well, we've had all these big sites in local authority ownership. You know, why did it take so long? You know, so we could have been using this mechanism for local authority owned sites. And it is obviously a mechanism that allows full transparency and public participation, but it has a shorter time track and there's a lot more certainty at the end of it.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for that. Non-political, but very, very interesting view on the housing plan proposed by Sinn Féin. That's Orla Hegarty, Assistant Professor in the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy at UCD. Now, one controversy at Leinster House has raged all week. Almost everyone seems to be in agreement that a bike shelter shouldn't cost €336,000, especially if it's taxpayers' money and holds just 18 bikes. We reckoned we could probably find it a little bit cheaper. And if you want to install one at your company for workers or just store your bike at home, well, Tom Considine is Managing Director of Safety Storage Systems and joins me now on the Home Show. Tom, you're very, very welcome. How much does a communal shelter for bikes typically cost?
Hi, Sinead. Well, typically you'll get a 10 bike shelter for less than €5,000 installed in your car park. A 30 bike similar size to the one in Leinster House, you'd be getting for about 25,000 installed, ready to go, fully enclosed on, well, fully enclosed on three sides, which are tow tracks for bikes.
Right. Yeah. Well, this one is enclosed on one side, which is the roof.
Which is the roof, that's right, yeah, yeah.
Right, for 18 bikes, so 25,000. Okay, so where do you think all this went wrong then?
Hard to say. I'm sure, you know, it doesn't look like a shelter that came from a standard range from anyone. Possibly there were a lot of professionals involved, architects and the like, maybe. I don't know what constraints there were on site. You know, the figure quoted, I guess, includes a lot of other ancillary, you know, site issues maybe around the bike shelter, but it would still seem, I would think, that shelter on site on Leinster House is... Yeah, it's a painted galvanised steel framework, and it's got toughened glass on the roof and a bit on it appears to have on the rear wall stainless steel bike hoops.
Very posh, is it?
It's not overly posh. It would be, you know, it'd be a little bit higher spec. I think that shouldn't be costing any more than 50,000.
Right, 50,000. So if the OPW had come to you and said, what would you do to install... We'll do all the bits and pieces here, checking everything out, because there's a cost to that, and that's fair enough. What would you cost to put in for 18 bikes covered on the roof with whatever materials get the job done? You'd say 50,000 tops.
Yeah. Well, we'd say anywhere from... We do a nice one, our Domo model, which is which is black painted steel, polycarbonate glazing, enclosed on three sides and the roof. We'd be doing that one for 25K, or if it was similar, more bespoke, similar to what they have put in a Leinster House, I'd be confident it'd be less than 50K.
Now, you have some experience here because you have done work on behalf of the OPW at St James's Hospital. So what did you make there and what did it cost?
Well, actually, for James's Hospital, it was for James's Hospital themselves. It wasn't the OPW, but that's quite a nice shelter. It's a bicycle hub. So it's a fully enclosed external shelter with toughened glass, nice graphics on the outside. It's got a swipe access, so it's fully secure. The staff there use their, you know, their entry cards to enter the door with a fob system, and it will park 50 bikes and some cargo bikes. So it's quite large. Nice shelter. It's at the main entrance there to St. James's Hospital, and that cost in the region of 80,000.
80,000.
For our side of it, for us to go up and install that shelter there. Yeah. So the hospital would have had some cost then around getting the base, putting a level base in and bringing electrics to the shelter.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, you sound very knowledgeable. I'm afraid you've answered none of the questions, no more than anybody else has, about what costs 336,000. So hopefully we will get some answers on it. But people at home who just have maybe one or two bikes or a set of family bikes, what options can you offer them? And I'm sure they are also a great deal under £750,000.
Yeah.
The price of a house.
Yeah, we've been making bicycle shelters now for over 20 years. So in that time, we had lots of inquiries from households who wanted to park bikes in their gardens or driveways. And the commercial shelters we do are not suitable. So we came up with our own design. It's called the Bike Shell. So it's a low product. It's like when it's closed, it's like a half circle with a nice bicycle graphic on the side. It's plastic manufactured from the same material as your wheelie bin, polyethylene. A child can open it as girls open and close it, but it's lockable then with padlocks on either side, and it'll store two or four bikes, just two models. And for the two bike, it would be costing you £1,230 delivered, including VAT, as delivered fully assembled. So that's quite popular for people's for domestic storage of bikes.
Right. So they could have bought nine of those.
Yeah.
For the 18 bikes, and saved themselves an absolute fortune, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, there you go. There'll be more on this now. This is a story, as they say, that has legs, if not wheels. Listen, Tom Considine, Managing Director of Safety Storage Systems, thanks for joining us and trying to help us unravel that mystery of the most expensive bike shelter in the world. All right. Thanks for coming on The Home Show. We are going to talk a little bit about autumn. And look, it's not quite chilly weather. And I know we're all hoping for a kind of a long Indian summer this month, but it's a good idea to start getting the garden furniture put away and start thinking about making our homes warm and cozy. So Paul Kinsler has joined me again to chat about how we can start wrapping our heads around that. I mean, it's not like we have had such a glorious summer that it's going to be a sea change, Paul.
No, it hasn't been. It's been very wet and I think we're all looking for the sun, but this is my favourite time of year.
I love being cold.
I don't like being wet, but I love that autumn winter vibe. That's my vibe. Mm. I love it. Christmas, if anyone knows me, I start Christmas in November 1st.
Okay, so we don't mention the C word the month begins with a D on The Home Show. But we can certainly start talking about crunchy leaves under the feet and, you know, the weather turning a little colder and more importantly, blankets and cushions and throws and all that kind of thing. So we've asked you to start thinking a little bit about what ways, you know, without doing a whole redecoration, that we can look at sustainably changing around our furnishings or adding to them just to make things a little bit more autumnal away from that summer look. So talk to me about what it is that you have are recommending.
Yeah, so I think you mentioned it there. Blankets and cushions are a great way to start introducing. And I think we talked about the last time, if we're a bit nervous around colour, it's a great way to start introducing colour into your room. And then looking at the textures, because we're going to get into more chunky blankets and faux fur and all that kind of warmth and texture. I think when you're looking at your room, it's nice to be tactile with it and have different sort of textures that you can embrace in it. introduce nice colours like deep greens, burnt oranges, those kind of ambery, warmy colours. A bit of plaid if you're into plaid. Not really my cup of tea, but for some people, they like plaid. Mm. So I definitely think that's a nice way to start introducing a change. And it doesn't have to be everything. It can be a cushion. It can be a throw. And then what you could pair it with is something very similar on the accessory line. So you might change out a vase to mirror the same colour. So then the colour starts to roam around the room and not just be sat on the sofa.
Oh, yeah. So that's a good idea to kind of tie it, your eye together with it.
Yeah. And so it follows around the room.
Now, if we've been following our design tips, we will have neutral furniture that allows us to do this, because that's the very reason that, you know, people like you recommend, you know, the beige sofa or the creams or the blacks or the greys. It's because then you can throw the colour pop in at different seasons.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I always say, when somebody is buying a sofa, sofas are meant to last for a good 7 to 10 years. So you have to be really in love with that navy blue suede sofa, which I have, if you want that. And you can still neutralise it down with different colours again. But I think it's that for people with choice, because we all love to change our minds all the time. I know I do all the time. My husband kills me. He's like, will you just leave our home alone? So I think neutral sofas then.
Maybe he means, will you leave me home alone and go off and shop elsewhere?
Yeah, he's now pawning me off to friends so I can do makeovers in their house. But I think with the neutral sofas, allow you to play a bit more with colour and find out what you really enjoy. Mm.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to cost a fortune. I know that you're into the old upcycling.
Love
and the recycling. So tell us a quick way we can do that with some wool.
With some wool, I've created throws into cushions. I found an old throw that I didn't want, and I created a really simple envelope stitch, it's called. And it's not fancy. You just sew up two sides and then you kind of put the cushion into it in an envelope style. And that was a really natural way for me to upcycle blankets and fleeces. And I've also seen other people do it with Aran sweaters, because
obviously
the texture on the Aran sweater is really cute.
Yeah, and you'd hate to throw out something like that, even if you're not going to wear it anymore.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic idea. Now, rugs. So I have a love-hate relationship with rugs, mainly because I love them, my husband hates them.
Okay.
But I also am never sure where to put them, because you have this idea that you have to be able to see it.
Yeah.
To me, it's no point in spending money and sticking it under the sofa.
Yeah, yeah.
But is there a tip or a technique about where they look best?
Yeah, and I see this happen a lot of times. People buy the wrong size rug, and I think the main thing with the rug is it's there to anchor your room. It's also there to bring a different texture to your flooring, be it if it's wood, it's just to soften it down. What I will say is it's not meant to go fully under your couch. Put it under the top legs of the couch. Have it sticking out over that, because what that does is it just anchors it. I've been in too many living rooms where there's been a rug just placed in between the gap where the sofa
and the fireplace.
And the fireplace.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, if you just go that extra 20 or 30 centimetres, it'll anchor again the room by putting the couch just on top of it, just at the legs. That's all it has to be.
Okay, and also it literally anchors it.
All
right, good idea. And of course, for this time of year, and you don't have to spend a fortune, we're not talking about Axminster carpets here, you can get, you know, that kind of hessian or kind of matte look.
I found a beautiful hessian one secondhand when I was filming Relove My Space for like, I think it was 30 or 40 euro. Really decent size. I think it was about 210 by 90. Like really chunky. And that was just somebody had done up their room and they changed their lifestyle. Mm. And then there's other places like Cocoon Rugs do really affordable rugging that don't cost everything.
Mm. Okay, brilliant. Now, we like an accessory on the home show. We love our accents. And of course, autumn is a perfect time to use what we have in nature.
Yeah, 100%. So when I start to build, I like to build some wreaths, and I use the stuff like your dried flowers, because hydrangeas now are starting to dry out. Mm. I've used hydrangeas on a wreath because they last for quite a long time. Pine cones. Again, I won't mention the C word, I'm so sorry. But I love a pine cone. And something so small as a pine cone introduced into your arrangements or your styling that's on a bookshelf will just bring in that little bite of awesome.
That's a great idea. Yeah, so take out a little statue or a little something and just put on a pine cone or...
A little bit around it,
A little bit around it. And I suppose twigs and branches and all that,
twigs
as long as they're...
and branches,
tidy.
Bringing the nature into the room.
Brilliant. Okay. Now, when it comes to lighting then, so up to now, you know, you hope in the summer you can rely on flooding natural sunshine coming through the odd day anyway. But when it comes to autumn, we know now the light is changing. Mm-hmm. It's changing earlier in the day.
Getting so dark.
Yeah. And it won't be long now before, you know, we have the solstice and all of that change. So give me some soft ways maybe that we can introduce new lighting.
So definitely you can have table lamps. Table lamps is a great way to add lighting into the room without having that harsh ceiling. But I love, it's candle season for me. I love candles. And I kind of have a multitude. They don't always have to be scented. And then that gives a brighter ambience if you pair two or three together. Mm. Usually like the candle, the church candle. Great.
Yeah, and not to just have one stuck on either side of the mantelpiece.
No.
To group them in odd numbers, isn't that the trick?
That's what we said, yeah. So your ones, threes, fives, and then in different heights. And it just makes them interesting.
And you can get them in so many different colours. So you don't have to use white or cream.
No, I love a green, a dark green. And I also, it's a nice way to introduce the burnt oranges into your room.
Perfect. Okay. Now, in repurposing some items that we have, I know we've spoken before about, you know, when you were doing your kitchen, just putting in the new handles or knobs on presses or things like that. And it's a really, really effective way to give it completely new look.
So, so effective. I actually added legs to my couch. They cost me maybe, I think, 20, 25 euro for 6 legs. I drilled them on myself and it gave me a new couch.
Go away.
Yeah.
Right.
Lovely gold legs against the navy fabric was delicious.
Beautiful.
In my opinion.
Yeah, very elegant.
But like what you said, the handles just change up. Sometimes you don't have to change everything.
Yeah.
A little handle, a little gold brass handle or a marble will just lift it for you completely.
And what's this about a bread bin?
So I actually turned a bread bin into a side table for the spare bedroom because we were a bit short on room. And for me, I just like I like a night desk or a night table beside the bed. I don't know, call me traditional. So what I did was flipped it on the side, added 4 legs to the bottom.
Oh, go away.
Hey, presto, hilarious. You have a bread bin nightstand.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's one of those ones where you lift it up and you've got a curve on it.
Yeah, and what I'll do is I'll share it for today so that people can see and take inspiration from it.
Okay, remind listeners of your Instagram.
Yeah, so it's life@number2 and I'm Paul Kinsler.
That's fantastic. Well, listen, Paul, great ideas there. And you've done it in a lovely autumnal voice.
Thank you. Nice way of thinking about it.
Great to have you. And we will have you back, of course, again to talk about maybe something nearer the C word.
Very
it's
exciting.
It's only September. We're not going there just yet. But listen, loads of changes. And I know you walk the walk and you talk the talk when you're doing it. So it comes across as very authentic. And we love that on The Home Show. So Paul Kinsler, life@number2 continues. And thank you very much for joining us on
The Home Show.
And that's all we have time for on this latest episode of The Home Show podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please tell your friends. And if you've missed any of the bits, well, of course, you can catch them because all of our episodes are up on wherever you got this podcast or indeed on the Newstalk app or newstalk.com. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear the topics you'd like us to cover and any guests you'd like me to have on. So do get in touch thehomeshow@newstalk.com if you want to do that, or you can direct message me on any of the socials where you can find me. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey. Researcher was Rory Galvin and Stephen McClune was on sound. We'll see you all again next time with The Home Show.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8 on Newstalk.